Today is November 8th, 2013. We're at the Michigan State University Libraries with Andres Gonzalez Guerrero, author of Chicano Theology. This interview will become part of the Mexican Voices Michigan Live series of people who have lived or experienced part of their lives in Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Deanna, for inviting me to look at your collection. It's nice, and the library.
Yes. Now, Andres Guerrero is a donor also to the Michigan State University Libraries. His papers can be found under the Andres G. Guerrero papers that are part of the Jose F. Treviño Activism Collections housed in special collections here. Your papers talk a lot about your professional experience, but I guess one of the things that I'd like to maybe provide a base for our listeners is who Andres Guerrero is. Like, where were you born? Where were you raised?
I was born in Second Ward, Texas, in February 11th, 1943. And I was there for 7 years. And then they started building the East Tex Freeway. Used to be a little, it was actually Shrimp Street, and now it's like a 12-lane super freeway over where I was born. But I was raised in East Texas, close to Humble, Texas, by Greensboro. And that's where I spent most of my, you would say, most of my intellectual development began there, yeah, there,
yeah,
in Kenwood. I spent a lot of time in the woods with my cousins. Yeah, that was our recreation. No drugs, no alcohol, none of that stuff. We just lived in, practically recreated in the woods and the bayou that it actually empties into the Gulf of Mexico, but has it starts in Sam Rayburn Lake and also Lake Livingston Lake. They both come together at a point, and that becomes Greensboro. Okay. It was a paradise, yeah.
Sam Rayburn Lake was what before it was Sam Rayburn Lake?
Oh, no, it wasn't even a lake. I think they, although both lakes are not natural lakes to East Texas, they were constructed for water for the whole East Texas area.
Okay.
Yeah. Huge lakes, by the way.
Your family is siblings, parents?
Oh, my parents have two lines. I have a Texas line and a Native American line. My great-grandfather was full-blooded. Rumor has it is Cherokee, but I have another theory that he might have been Comanche. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I got to read a little bit more about the history of Comanches, because most of them, according to Marines. Juan Marines, most Comanches spoke Spanish by the time the English came to Texas.
Okay.
They were Spanish speakers. And I'm sure that more than Comanches spoke Spanish, because the Spanish language had already been in Texas for over 200 years. Yeah.
Okay.
So Apaches spoke Spanish too. Mm-hmm. And the Cherokees, of course, spoke Spanish too. Yeah.
And your siblings?
And my siblings, they were three boys and three girls. There were more, but only three girls and three boys made it. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm the oldest of six. I am almost 19 years older than my sister. I am 19 years older than my sister, Maria. It's Maria, Cecilia, Esperanza, Roberto, and Johnny. Roberto being older than Johnny. Johnny's the baby.
Growing up, what were the reading materials in the home?
Oh, growing up, the reading materials, my mama read a lot. Okay, she's a reader. She could read both languages, English and Spanish, and she taught herself with the help of a lady in East Texas. She started reading the Bible, and that's how she learned to read, through the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I found out at Harvard, that's how we teach foreign languages, using the Bible at Harvard, too. Yeah.
Wow.
Interesting. And my dad was just a worker, not a reader. He wrote like he spoke, so both of my parents were, functionally, could not read and write, yeah.
But they could read the Bible.
But they read the Bible. I mean, my mama could read, and she did read both languages, but not my dad. But my dad was the one that wrote like he spoke. Dad wrote no period, no that I could read what he was saying to me when he would write to me.
Is that what you learned reading, or is that what you were reading in the home then?
No, most of the things that I was reading, I was considered a good student even in elementary school is because I was old. I was the oldest student in my class, 2 years older than anyone else. Part of that was because I didn't speak Spanish to start out with when I was going to school, so I kind of had to learn the English first. So I spent like 1 year in limbo, kind of. My mama didn't let me go to school till I was about 8 years old. Yeah, I graduated from high school when I was almost 21. Yeah, okay. I was 20. I was going to be 21. Yeah.
When you graduated, then did you know that you were going to college?
Yes, I did, because a lot of my professors were very instrumental in when I was in, even in, especially in junior high, where are you going to go study? Where are you going to go study? That was always put in my mind early. Not by my family, but by my teachers. So my teachers had a lot of influence in, you know, in my intellectual and my political economic development, yeah. Which at that point was, all right, conservative. The more of the openness came during the Mayo movement in Houston. Oh, when I was like in my my second year and third year in theology.
What is Mayo?
It's the Mexican-American youth organization that in a sense made me go through a metanoia, you know. It's really, really, really brainwashed by the system, as they might say, as you would say. Because I wasn't challenging anything that was being taught. I just took things for granted. My father was probably the greatest challenger I had. Because I remember my father saying, remember that this book was written by a man just like yourself. No better, no less than you, just like you. I said, you know. So my father, if anything, put that in my mind. Later on, that got developed in college by one of my professors especially. He said this to me one time. It was in 1964.
College did you go to?
I went to the University of St. Thomas, Catholic University there. I was in the seminary. I entered the seminary right after high school, yeah. And it was an abrupt awakening because my school was going to be paid by my father's bosses, but they didn't give me a penny after I graduated from high school because they knew I was going to the seminary, so they didn't. So I saved all my money since I was 15 years old. My mother saved all my money. And I gave all that money to the seminary the first year I went there, which was a lot of money. And today's, it was over $2,000 that I had. That's, in that time, that was a lot of money. But it was all given to the seminary. So, mm-hmm.
So your father was your biggest challenger?
He was my biggest challenger when my father would say that, you know. And then, you know, I remember saying, look, Dad, he's here in this book. I don't know, I'm sure other people have had this experience. He took that book and tore it into so many pieces I couldn't put it together again. It was one on a church doctrine. That's what it was. I said, look, it's here in the Bible. I said, oh, he got angry. So my father was kind of, you could say he was kind of anti-intellectual in that sense. My father's vision was, you know, let's get to work, let's get the job done, and just cut all this other bullshit out. Let's do it. And that was it. And my mother was more like a real Southern Baptist. And I found out later on my mother was raised as a Southern Baptist first. She's more open-minded, more liberal, open to all kinds of challenges coming to you. You know, she was very open-minded. So I got a little of both. Yeah, maybe more of my mother, because my theology is more of my mother's theology. Yeah.
How was theology school for you as a Mexican-American?
Oh, my God. Oh, okay, that's a good question. The thing is that the formation and education of the seminary, and it's still going in, which is really sad and tragic, because it's very Eurocentric, and it doesn't really leave room to the native mind. And this is very more important and might lead to something else when we're talking about leadership later on. But the native mind is not a European mind. You know, the thing is, somebody should write a book called it Inquest of the Native Mind. What is the native thinking? And that's one of the things that one of the professors at St. Thomas asked us one time, because, you know, I was always challenged and I was trying to excel, you know. And I said, and when I gave the answer, and he said, no, 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 no. He said, that's what the Anglo-Saxon is thinking. I want to know what the Mexicans are thinking. And I thought to myself, what the Mexicans are thinking? Well, I didn't even know we could think. Notice what I just said. I didn't even know we could think. Because during the formation, notice what I said. I didn't say education. I said formation of a native mind. You're not listening to what the native mind is saying. You're telling the native mind how to think, how to read even your own soul. You're telling them that. This is why the dangers of assimilation are more dangerous when people realize what they're doing. You're actually asking the people to forget about your identity. And if you study Native American policy in the United States, you will find out that the whole thrust was forget that you're a Native American. What is that? Forget that you're a Native American. So they were doing the same thing to any immigrant, not only Mexicanos, but any immigrant coming to this country. I will say this, that the only ones that have managed to maintain an identity that's different from the European mind has been the Chicano. And I can't speak for Latin America, Central America, or the Caribbean, nothing. But the Chicano mind, in this sense, it's not what people think it is. The Chicano mind is understood by the Chicano and the Chicana. Beyond that, they haven't really given us an opportunity to say what that is. But I think it's the last hope for the whole, not the country, the whole hemisphere. Because we have a mission. I think Mexico and the United States, Latino, especially the Mexicano, have a mission. Now, it could fall on the Puerto Rican too and the Cuban. But it's the mainland of the United States does not belong to Puerto Rico nor to Cuba, but it does belong to us. And that's very important because part of our Native American heritage, which is stronger than what most people realize. I remember hearing Saginaw, Mr. Falan, telling me, Andres, we're more like the Native American in many respects than we are the European, the Spaniard in that sense. Mm-hmm. And he's right. I believe that. And one is, when you do something wrong to the Indian, he never forgets. And that's why we have to put him in reservations, because he's not going to forget. And I believe in the future, we're really, really sincere about ourselves. Notice that. I didn't say about others. I mean, about ourselves. We will see the Native American in a whole different sense.
So have you just told me what the Chicano mind is, or can you tell me what the Chicano mind is?
I would address that question as this. Leadership is very important. I think, and when I say leadership, I'm off to qualify. We're talking about leadership that is focused around the needs and the visions and dreams of where not only where our people are going as Chicanos and Chicanas, but where the country's going. Okay, so the answer is there. It's the good leadership, I guess, the way I'm going to qualify it. Good leadership, enlightened leadership, you might say. The other one would be the concept of family and community, and I'm going to put those together. And I think that family has to be understood, not just your immediate family, but your family as a community and as a nation, both. And the third one is organizing all that, putting all that into some kind of package and say, this is what the Chicano mind is. And so the elements of culture are there, the elements of religion are there, the elements of who we are as a kind of like a nation within a nation. And I've heard that expression before, but I hadn't understood it in that context now, and that's what it is. And the reason I mentioned these four themes too is because I said I left them out in my study of a Chicano theology. And they actually are the answers to the problems that were presented by all the leadership in the Chicano community. Yeah. So I'm just saying that, and some of the issues were like education, labor. It's only two out of 12 issues. So theology itself. What is theology? What is ecclesiology? What is church? How do we understand our own symbols? Yeah, so.
Do you believe in the concept of or the theory of an internal, Chicanos as an internal colony, a colonized community in the U.S.?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it exists there just as it exists with the Native American community, and somewhat too like the African American community. Yeah, or the female community. We want to use that, the woman community. Yeah. It's an entity that should have always been there, but it wasn't. And now we're seeing the need for it as, instead of progressing, we're regressing, you know. We need to progress. We can't go back. Yeah. So there are new voices, you know.
You graduated from Harvard Divinity School in 19...
I left in 1982. I finished my dissertation in 1984.
From Boston, then, you came to Michigan.
No, from Boston, I went to Chicago. I wanted to go back home. I actually did. But my bishop asked me a question, and he said, have you changed? And I said, Bishop, has the situation here changed since I left? And as far as Chicano leadership and the whole concept of who we were, where we were already absent at that point. 8 years, then they were gone. All the people that I knew and I worked with were gone.
He was asking you, have you changed? Changed from what or to what?
Well, had I changed from being a Chicano to becoming assimilated into Anglo-Saxon mind view? And I instead of saying, no, I haven't changed, I just said, has the situation here changed? Because I was more concerned about what was happening to the Latino community, Chicano community, Chicana community in this context in Houston. And and instead of something happening, nothing was happening. They were being relegated to a periphery more and more and more and more. And so the church was becoming more and more acculturated to you know, mindset of, the way I see it, the mindset of materialism and capitalism. Instead of the spirituality of the Latino, it's not there.
Okay, and you headed to Chicago?
To Chicago from there, and I think the biggest mistake that I made was that I really thought I was in a very progressive school. Like, I thought at Harvard I was in a very progressive school, and I find out when it came to us, the Latino, the Chicanos specifically, and the Chicana, they had no idea. And what's really tragic, they still have no idea. And I think that we need to talk. Yeah. Just like we need to talk with the Native American community instead of keeping them on the reservations. But that's no place to keep a Native person in that reservations. I mean, what's the difference between that and South Africa?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
There is no difference. Yeah.
What did you do in Chicago?
Well, in Chicago, my first thing I tried to do is try to set up a program. And I had ideas because I already knew my community, but I wanted to test it anyway. So I went into the community, what kind of courses can we have that would help you develop your own leadership skills, your own community building skills, your organizational skills, your own family skills? And the school was not ready for that. So what was going to be a program that was going to address that issue and bring in the larger community was in this case with the Irish Catholic German community. They got threatened and they ran, and the program capitulated into a spirituality program instead of a social, economic, and spiritual program all working together. They just decided to again relegate it to their periphery of what the curriculum was, like most schools do today. They do that. They still doing it.
What school was that?
That was CTU.
Chicago.
Catholic Theological Union, which was the number one theologian in Catholic theology in the United States. Yeah, great people there. But you also had great minds, but also great retreaters. They didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to venture into the unknown. And it is the unknown, because we really do not know. Till today, we really do not know where the Chicano, we know where we're going. But if people do not understand that, that is not our problem. You know, we have to keep going and moving forward.
Where are we going as a Chicano?
As a Chicano community, I think we're going to something more humanistic, more socialistic, more toward a cosmovision of reality is a better way. I think Elizondo uses that word a lot, you know, cosmovision.
Mm-hmm. Virgilio Elizondo.
Virgil Elizondo is the first. I don't know. I've never heard. Elizondo said that he's a Chicano theologian, but he's a Chicano theologian, yeah. But he's the first, you know. I'm the second, okay. And Ponce would have been the second, but Ponce passed away. Ponce was a great mind, too. Frank Ponce from San Bernardino. So you had one Californian and two Texans, yeah. Yeah, and then later on we have others that came from other places, yeah.
You left Chicago.
I left Chicago, and I wanted to leave Chicago. It's just, because I like Chicago, and I knew, you know, that if we, I think this is another thing about academia. Academia needs to be closely related to the community, you know, to the people that we work with. And if you divorce yourself from the community, then you actually create another environment where you already lose the reason why you are. You know, and that happens a lot to academia. You cannot leave the trenches, basically. So I really consider myself a theologian, still in the trenches, trying to relate to the upstairs. Not as far as I said, trying to relate to the upstairs, but in the meantime, relating to what's going on down here. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about liberation theology from the third world. Notice I didn't just say Latin America, Africa, and Asia. It's all the same theology. You know? Mm-hmm. You can't divorce the haves from the have-nots. In order for the haves to be, they have to understand what the have-nots are. Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't, then you're in lolly land, you know. You're not there, you know. I mean, you're doing a lot of research, but like my father said, why are you doing all that reading? How's that going to help you do the work that we need to do? So if there's not a intercommunion between the academy and the community in this sense, then we're in lolly land, yeah. Mm-hmm. We're not there.
Is the church there?
Oh, absolutely. The church there? No, the church is in the lolly land too. Okay. It's not really ministering to the people that it should be ministering to. It's ministry to a concept of church that's possibly not there anymore, you know, because disjointed somehow there. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that this new pope will ordain women, for one, and then ordain married men, which means he'd have to ordain married women, too. One.
And Pope accept, Francis.
Yeah, and accept, I predict that he's going to do it. Yeah, because it's time. Somebody, well, why should he do it? Oh, he'll never do it, you know. And the reason I say is because it's time. Yeah, enough, you know. It's just like I said, it's time for the university, for the academy to listen to what the grassroots is doing. It's time. We can't wait. We don't have any more time. It's time to come together and find solutions to the problems that in many sense, the academy creates itself by disjoining, you know, the people in the trenches with the people in the academy. That has to come together.
From Chicago?
From Chicago, I went to Saginaw, thanks to Yolanda Tarango. She knew Sister Lupe Silva, who probably knows the thumb better than anybody I have ever known, anyway, because she was born and raised there. Sister Lupe was a great role model for me, yeah. Yeah. And she is the one who told me, you might think that the bishop knows what Latinos are, but he doesn't know. And I said, but how can somebody who studied under one of the greatest minds of Vatican II, which was Yves Congar, not know? Well, I found out the hard way that he didn't know. He was trying to be more open-minded to the issue of women, and that's great because we do need that too. But we also need an open-mindedness to racial, even though we're not considered a racial group, we are a racial group, of course, but culture, the culture of a race, yeah. In this, the Mexican race. All Latinos, of course, but in specifically the Mexican, because that's the one they're contending with now. And it's the largest group that's going. We saw that. We saw that was coming. And it's not going to get any less. It's going to get more. I just read that there were 78, since 2008, 78 tunnels have been discovered under the Rio Grande. I said, oh my God, that's the only, we've known of 70, but God knows how many of them might be. You got 2,000 miles of border to do a tunnel.
Sure. Ludicrous. So in Michigan, you worked with Sister Lupe Anguiano.
No, Lupe Silva.
Lupe Silva.
An Adrian Dominican.
Adrian Dominican. And she was in the thumb?
In the thumb. She was born in Bad Axe, if I remember correctly. Bad Axe. Born there. Okay. Bad Axe.
That actually is a name that I don't know when it comes to ministry of Mexican Americans and Chicanos in Michigan. Oh. But it's someone it's good to know to follow up on then.
Yeah.
So you were in Saginaw. Mm-hmm. And
for about 7 years, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what was your role there?
I was first they put me as coordinator of Hispanic ministries. That was after there had been a downfall by a Colombian that had come in to become the minister, the director of the ministry program.
In the Saginaw Diocese?
Yeah. And the big mistake that a lot of Latinos make, especially people working with the poor in Latin America, and people working with the poor in the United States. It's that poverty is poverty. It doesn't matter where you are. You can be in China, you can be in Russia, you can be in the United States. Poverty is poverty. The thing that we've managed to do is that we managed to sophisticate it and hide it better than other cultures. But you know, you have the haves and you have the have-nots. And as long as you're going to have that duality, well, you're going to have a duality in your existence, basically. You're not going to be together. You're not going to be one. And we need to be one. That's, I think, yeah. I think that's what one thing that Chicano mind would say. We need to be one. But not, no, and nobody lording it over others. Because I think that's the big thing. Because you're educated, because you're highly spiritualized, whatever the thing may be, then that gives you privilege to lord it over others. No, that's not a privilege. That's nonsense. Mm-hmm. But people say, no, that's the way reality is. No, that reality is that way because that's the way we want it to be. But that doesn't necessarily, that's the way it ought to be. What it ought to be is, you know, is a unity in community or something like that. So working together, basically, living together, respecting one another. I think it's another thing that a lot of the people that get educated think that they need to be more respected than those that are not educated. In our culture, we say, no, that's not an excuse for you not to respect me or for me not to respect you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be that element of respect, yeah.
So you were with the Saginaw Diocese in Hispanic ministry.
Yeah.
And working probably, what, a 5 or 6 county area?
11 county area.
11 county yeah. area. And were you doing programming, or can you tell what it was?
It was leadership development. That's leadership. What it really was. Because they wanted leaders so we could go in. We actually, by the time I got there, we were ready to take any parish. There was one tragic fall that happened. A group of ministers was put in a black area of Greeley, and it was a disaster because the blacks did not respect the Mexicanos at that point, and they just broke in and just created all kinds, and that scared the bishop, I think.
Would that be Greeley or Saginaw?
I'm sorry, that's Saginaw. Saginaw. Okay. I mean Saginaw. I didn't mean Greeley. Greeley is where I live now. No.
And the leadership development that you were doing was to have parishes in different, Latino parishes in different communities?
Not necessarily Latino. It could have been any parish that a priest could not go to because a lot of priests, celibate priests, do not like to be out in the boonies by themselves. So I say, well, if you send a married couple, I mean, that was my own idea. If you send a married couple, at least, you know, you have a couple there, you have a small family or a large family, as the case may be. But they would, in a sense, the ministers would be running the parish, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you can invite a priest to come, say, once a week and say a mass, you know, especially in the real boonies out there in the, you know, where nobody wanted to go. Mm-hmm. But there's a community there of Catholics, yeah.
Okay.
And they could be mixed or they could be all white or all brown. It doesn't matter to me. You know, we could do any of that. Because we don't have trouble working with the Anglo-Saxon community. Now, the Anglo-Saxon community does have trouble working with us because they think that they're better. And, you know, like I said, well, nobody's better. We can... If you can do a good job in a Mexican-American, you can do it in anywhere. Yeah.
Sure.
Except don't brainwash the people to think that they're all Anglo-Saxon when they're not Anglo-Saxon. We're not Irish, German Catholics, you know. We're not. We're Mexican Catholics.
There was an agency, Latin American Affairs Division of the Catholic Diocese,
yeah,
is that
Saginaw,
correct?
Yeah.
Of Saginaw. Is that where you worked out of?
Yeah, I worked out of there.
Okay.
It was one of the most progressive, by the way, it was one of the most progressive lay ministry programs. Yeah. I happened to start the first Catholic lay ministry, Hispanic ministry program in the country at CTU, the one where I was exited from. So in a sense, we were not really wanted up that high, you know, in the intellectual group of the lay ministry. I mean, not lay ministry, Hispanic ministry. So in a sense, I got into the ground. Into the trenches of what it was, you know, mm-hmm. not at the academy. This is working in the community. But what I didn't realize until later was that I was inviting some of the best minds. Notice what I said, some of the best minds in the areas of ecclesiology, theology, church history, political theology and things like that were some of the best minds. And I didn't know that until afterwards. I said, oh my God. And when I said, no wonder these people were ready to move. Mm. Yeah.
So you got there. Obviously, there may have been challenges, but Can you tell me two of the biggest challenges that you ran into and two of the greatest successes or gains maybe occurred in that area?
I think the gain was this, that the leadership can be developed. I think that's the gain. It can be developed if it's done the right way. Okay, and that is this, you want your people to excel. You don't want your people to be seen as third class or second class citizens. You want your people to feel, when I say your people, I mean the Latino in this case, the Mexican American, the Chicano. You want your people to feel that they are somebody, that they're worth something, and not treated, well, pobrecitos, they don't know, they're dumb, or whatever idea the Anglo-Saxon mind has about the Latino, which is, again, ludicrous. But anyway, we wanted to get that Sheila, and we were successful in that. But what I didn't know was that the other side was not ready. And I was actually told, well, we're not ready for that. You know? So it'll be telling like a woman, well, you're not ready to be free. You know, we wanted you to stay home, take care of the children, you know, cook and do all this. And the woman might say, well, at this point, I don't want to do it anymore. So then the male has to contend with that. But instead of contended with it, he resists it. And I think that's what happened with our program. That there was resistance to that movement forward.
Like, we're not ready to let you Latinos lead into
or even be equal. We didn't even talk about it. We just did. Just see us as equals, you know. I remember that when I left, they hired the first Latina at the diocese. Because before that, there was only another... another person working there, but she was not paid by the diocese. Outside of the Latin American affairs, the mindset is okay. We establish program, and we put everybody that's Latino to work with that program. I think one of the biggest shocks that Sister Lupi had was when she was told, "Well, now you got to minister to the Anglo-Saxon too." About you, and Sister Lupi would say, "But we need more Latinos. You want me to do this job? I can barely do this job with the few that I have. You have to give me a..." And I think that was a shock there, because the bishop said, no, you're not going to get more people to work for you, but you need to work on the other side. I said, no. So there was a shock there with my boss. Mm-hmm. So I knew my time was coming sooner or later, too, because, mm-hmm. you know. Because I think all Latinos are, you know, they know what's going on. I think that's one of the big things that people in power don't realize in this country is that they think that the people that they have power over don't know what's going on, and we know what's going on. I think that's the Chicano mind right there. We know what's going on. The Mexican American, a lot of times, why worry about that? Or the immigrant from Latin America, why worry about that? No, we have to worry about that because this is your country. Mm-hmm. It doesn't belong just to the German and to the Irish and to the immigrant. It belongs to everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's important.
Okay. So who were key names or key people in leadership, theological or religious or community leadership in this ministry that you worked on?
Internally or externally?
Well, internally it would be administrative. Externally would be the leaders that were developed, right?
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of them. Matias Escamilla would be a good leader. Alicia Mosqueda, and I mean, I came from really 2 days to get to Saginaw, Michigan, because it's her 90th birthday. And Alicia was a person that she knows who she is, and she knows what our community is capable of. So, and she's one of the old ministers, Maria Camarillo, Sofia Fuentes. Oh, my God, I wish I knew everybody's name. But we had like 55 ministers, yeah.
Okay. Most of them sound like they're women.
Well, no, they were men too. Matias Escamilla was female. Okay. But yeah, there were more women, though. There were more women than men, yes. Mm-hmm. Because women had more time, I guess, you know. When you work at the plant and, you know, you're tired, you don't want to get involved with ministry. But I will say some did get involved. There were quite a few men. I would say that, but the ratio was like 2-1. Mm-hmm. 2-1, yeah.
So
can I qualify that?
Sure.
Also, in the culture, women tend to be more spiritual, I think, than men. Men are more skeptical about religion, and women tend to be more culture, more, and you know, religion is part of culture, more más concentradas in that. They see beyond, kind of, that mm-hmm. women. We're more practical, I think. My dad was like that. My mama was highly spiritual. I could see that. more so than my dad. My dad was very formal, and very strict too. So.
You had at one point off tape mentioned the awakening of the community, that there was a previous history in Michigan of Latinos in Michigan that had existed that you learned or...
Well, I think the fact that we had leaders coming to... The fact that we had leaders coming to the to give us these presentations, you know, and I did that for about close to 7 years, was an awakening for them. They didn't know that they had those capabilities, or they didn't know they became, if they were intelligent and they were intelligent, well, with more education, they became more aware of what they could do. Yeah.
Did you learn more about the history of Latinos in Michigan, in Saginaw?
Yes, I didn't know they had been treated so badly in the beginning when they first got here. Again, treated like strangers, and in a sense, strangers in their own land, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though they were immigrants from Mexico and immigrants from the Southwest that came to Michigan. Because Michigan is an agricultural community for the most part. For our people, it was, you know. And then it became an industrial community because they started working for the factories and everything. One of the things that I realized that it wasn't the fact that if your parents made more money, you would be more favored. No, because the school system does not move. It's kind of stagnant. So even though the families made more money, we had the same problems here in Michigan that you would have in Houston or San Antonio or Sacramento, and I've never been there. But I know it's the same system. And what needs to develop together with the people is the system itself needs to wake up and needs to develop. It's not develop, it's stagnant. And the more we keep it stagnant, the less can people move, you know. And when I mean movement, become more enlightened, you know. Mm-hmm. That has to be there in the curriculum. The curriculum today is not developed, even though we talk about it. I talked to Dr. Raquel Ontiveros, and I think she might have gotten her degree from here. No, I think she got it from University of Michigan. I said, well, what does the system consider to be curriculum? You're the only one in the Midwest, Raquel, that I know this in curriculum development. And she says, when I finally got to it, she says, well, Cinco de Mayo and 16 de Septiembre. The two events of liberation in Mexico from the French and from the Spanish. The Spanish and the French. And he said, that's it? He said, yeah, that's it. I said, oh, my God, that's not what the curriculum development is. Curriculum development is this, is you take cultures, the leadership of the cultures, and you work together and you try to come up with a system that works for everyone, not just for some. Those that are willing to be assimilated, see, it'll work for them. And hopefully that they won't stay assimilated, but it will challenge the people that gave them the opportunity to, you know. Okay. And if it doesn't happen, well, nothing happens. Like I have to confess, but I don't see it. I don't see the curriculum moving in the direction of the future. I see it not moving at all. It's just stagnant.
And that's the K-12 curriculum.
K through PhD. Not K through 12. K through PhD. Because your education doesn't stop at 12. It goes into your master's, your PhD, post PhD. You know, because the problems are across the board. Yeah. Yeah. And you would think, here's another. You would think that the more people get educated, the more they can see what's going on. Not necessarily. Very few that can break out of the
obviously
so, no break out of the come on, break out of the syndrome.
Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, right. Something I don't know, but anyway, I think one of the bad things about when I did go to Harvard, I said, God, I thought this place was progressive, but it's kind of like the mother of the
hegemony.
No, how do you say it? It's like the roots of the world. Because I went to an East Texas school, and the philosophy of the East Texas school, elementary through, K through 12, and the one, you know, master's through PhD at Harvard said, oh, my God, there is no difference. It's the same formation, the same, you know. They see us like we don't even see ourselves. You know, the first thing the controller there said, remember not to steal anything. What? I mean, I told him, don't worry, there's nothing worth stealing here, you know, and of course... There's stuff there that, you know, is priceless.
Right.
Don't bring it to the Peabody Museum, all right. or the Fog Museum.
Anyway, your dissertation.
Okay.
Is what your book is based on. Chicano theology.
Yeah.
And in it, you talk about historical perspectives on the Chicano cosmic experience of oppression.
Okay.
You did interviews with key people in theology, Chicanos.
Some in theology, some in politics, in sociology. Yeah, I try to do the whole, and women, of course. Women really wanting to see women move, advance, you know.
Are there areas that you would have liked to have expanded further on from that book?
Not really. I think everybody just, the themes that I presented, I think, were key to the developments of, you know, of the Chicano mind, we would say, or Chicana mind is the case, as both. I would have liked to focus more on the need, if we see it as a need, but it's also a solution, organizing. Like, one of the big questions is, why don't we teach classes and may make it in the BA degree? Classes on organizing. How does one organize communities so that all the communities benefit? And have we really studied what leadership is? That's the other question. Because no one mind can say what a leadership is, but you need a community. Okay, that's also a need, but it's also the answer. So both, organizing. And the concept of family is very important, because it's not just my family, it's our family, you know. We're one, and that has to be. That's why I think Nikolai, one of my resources for my academic resources, okay. I think, you know, how do you say?
So at one point, you were talking about the big issue in the U.S.
Oh, the big issue in the U.S.
The education of Mexican-American, and you pretty much made it clear that Mexican-American being different than Chicana and Chicano.
Yeah. I think the thing is about the Mexican-American, he's kind of more assimilative type of, when you say I'm a Mexican-American, it's like saying I'm an African-American, or not necessarily saying I'm a Native American. Notice what I'm saying, that the Native American is still relegated to, you know, second class and third class citizenship, and it shouldn't be like that. We should actually listen to what the Native American is telling. In many issues, one, ecology, which is a big, big problem now in the you know, in the surface or the ecology of the United States. Let's see. So the Chicano understands the politics, basically, what's going on, and the Chicana. And I think that's what makes us different from new immigrants coming to this country. They have these grandiose ideas of what it's like. But once they're here for a while, they said, oh, my God, we didn't know this was going on here. But we've known that for ages, you know. And that's the thing, instead of being, instead of being an eye-opener for the people that are, you know, controlling everything, it becomes, they don't know what to do, you know. But they don't want to include this group either in whatever they want to, where they want to go. And they need to include these groups. You need to include these groups to find solutions to the problems facing the nation. No one group is going to find the answer to that. That's what I believe. As a theologian, I would say that. And I do consider myself a theologian, not so much an academic theologian, but more of a community-oriented theologian. Yeah. That's why if a regular academic theologian challenges me, he won't get me, because he doesn't know what's going on down there. And I do know what's going on down there. I also know what's going on up there.
And when you say up there, I know down there you're talking about the community, being in the trenches, as you say. Yeah. And then up there is...
It's the system that excludes the mindset that's going on down there.
Okay. Yeah. And that system is education?
No, I explained back, but it's not a two-way street. Okay. The academy sees the community as a one-way street. What can we get from you? What can we get? Which is the actually, it's also the mindset of the colonizer and the conqueror and the imperialist. What can we, how can we, not we together, but we as separate from they, how can we, you know, benefit from this? Instead of saying, what can I do to make it a better world for both? So it's a two-way street, mm-hmm. not a one-way street. The problem with the power, as we understand it, is that it's a one-way street. It's not a two-way street. And in order for power to be humanistic or for be more, holistic or more human, it's got to be a two-way street. And that's the problem with how we see leadership today, not only in the United States, but in the world.
Okay.
That it's a one-way street. If it's true leadership, it's got to be a two-way street. It cannot be a one-way street. I don't know if I make myself clear with that, but what I'm saying is that it's not just about me. It's about us. I think that's really important.
Okay. If a high school student were listening to this tape and they would be asking, what does power, who is power, who is up there, what would you say it were people? Would you say it was institutions? If so, which institutions or which people?
In that context, I would say it's the institution of both religion and state. Okay, it's that power structure. And who has a say-so in that? So if only the elite have say-so on that, that's not true leadership. That's false leadership because it's not inclusive. It's got to be inclusive, you know. For any power to be, notice that, to be, it's got to be inclusive. If it's exclusive, it's a power that ought not to be, really.
Right.
And I think James Luther Adams, who's one of the great theologians in this country, said it best in an article he printed in 1955. And I read that article. It's called The Theological Basis for Social Action. Notice that, The Theological Basis for Social Action. And it looked like, oh my God, this is like liberation theology. This is what the liberation theologians are saying. And what he talks about in that article is the concept of power. We have to see power as a gift from God, and then we have to use it like God would want us to use it, not like we would want to use it. But what happens in that concept of power, that instead of God being God, we become God. And that's where we go off the chart. And we need to be on the chart. Yeah.
Okay.
So power is key. That's why leadership is key, too. Because good leadership is going to have a good concept of power. But bad leadership is going to have a bad concept of power. Yeah, bad concept of power.
At one point you had said the way leadership and the way it needs to progress.
Well, the only way it can progress is by listening. Power groups need to listen to groups that are not empowered. But the concept of power that we'd have is, I have the power now, take it from me. And I think this was the big mistake with the African-American and the women's liberation movement, is that they forgot that they also got help from these other groups. And now these other groups, especially the Chicano and Chicana group, need help. And instead of they also put relegated. So instead of bringing humanity to the concept of power, they just absorbed it, or power absorbed them. So you always had, and I see power, bad power is the devil. Seriously, that's how the devil works. So you always got to be contending with evil. And until we make it to heaven or to hell, as the case may be, I hope not too many of us make it to hell, right? But it's a struggle. It will always be a struggle. No matter how beautiful you paint the world, it's not heaven. You know? So you're always fighting evil. And I see evil as very real, not as a myth or something. Because a lot of people say there isn't a devil. Well, if there's authorship to good, there must be authorship to evil too. So you contend with that, because a lot of people don't believe that. I'm an atheist, yeah. But how do you deal with evil then? How do you deal with good? Mm-hmm. There has to be a source for all this. Okay. It can't just be us. We're not that powerful. I mean, we're powerful, but not that powerful.
You have four children. and they're grown. Mm-hmm. The message that you give or have given to your children to help them with ethics, with direction, with leadership, and just being a person. What would you say to a younger person listening to this interview for them to succeed, to be leaders?
Well, I would say learn as much as you can. Yeah, and this is not mine, okay? This comes from the community. Learn as much as you can, but never forget who you are. I think that's important. You have to know who you are. And a lot of times, people will try to tell you who you are, but you have to know who you are. And that's a problem because you're not taught to know who you are, you know? And another one is really, really important, I think, even beyond that, is to love yourself. I think in our K through PhD in the curriculum, you don't see that written anywhere. They take it for granted that you should love yourself. In understanding this, and this is theology again, love yourself like God loves you, and prove that by loving your others like God loves you, or like you would love yourself. And I think that at the bottom, after about 5 years ago, I wrote an article, and it was 20 years after Chicano theology. I came with the conclusion that in order to sustain institutions of violence, you have to be teaching unconsciously or consciously or collectively uncollected, whatever you want to call it, you're teaching hate. And I think my proof for that is what Martin Luther King Jr. said in the letter to the Birmingham jail. And he pointed fingers at the Jewish church, the Christian church, and the Protestant church. He says, you have not been teaching love to your people, and so how can you express it to others? And that message needs to be heard, because that's what the leadership needs to do, teach love so we can stop hating one another. Because hate just doesn't come up from there. Mm-hmm. So it's a struggle. So good has to fight evil. And I believe, I'm a theologian, a Christian theologian. I believe the good will eventually overpower evil, but it takes a lot of work. We can't just let somebody else do it. Mm-hmm. We can just say, well, we're going to do it. No. We have to do it together. It's a collective effort. You have to fight evil collectively, not individually. Wherever it comes from, in any form, any shape, form, or way it comes, you face it head on. And that's important, head on, you know. That's all we have to do. That's what I believe. I don't know. Well, I do know that. Okay. All right. Está bien? All right. Well, thank you.